Hello, it is May 13th, 2014. This is episode 416 of the Will Leafs Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. Today's death, Gary Cooper, who died May 13th, 1961. The son of a member of the Montana Supreme Court, Cooper had failed as a cartoonist, photographer, electrician, and salesman when he moved back in with his parents in Los Angeles at the age of 25. He bummed around getting work as a film extra before breaking through in a supporting role with the 1927 film Wings, which is the first film ever to win the Academy Award for Best Picture. He received his first Oscar nomination 10 years later in Mr. Deed Goes to Town, and he turned down the lead role in Gone with the Wind in 1939, saying, quote, "Gone with the Wind is going to be the biggest flop in Hollywood history. I'm glad it'll be Clark Gable who's falling flat on his nose, not me." He won his second Oscar for High Noon, considering his best role. He was married to the same woman for 30 years, but famously had countless affairs. He would not grant his wife a divorce because he converted to Catholicism late in life. He also testified before HUAC as a friendly witness. He was diagnosed with colon cancer in 1960 and died from it at the age of 60. He is buried in Southampton, New York. Here in Boston, there was merely Tuesday. I'm Will Leach. I think you're spending part of your day with me. We finished up that Only a Game show last night. I hope you enjoyed it. All right, to be honest with you, I'm actually taped this episode before I did that show. So, assuming perhaps I had a heart attack on stage, perhaps I said something horrible and my career is over, I honestly don't know. But you know better than I do because you live in the future. So, assuming I didn't destroy everything I've ever worked for and the way that I pay for my family to eat and have a house over their head, no, a roof over their head, if they had a house over their head, I mean, it seems like an architectural issue. Anyway, so I'm coming back to Athens this week, but today I'm still in Boston, even though, you know, I'm from the past and you're in the future. Anyway, today's guest I'm glad to have is Richard Sandomir. He is the TV sports columnist for the New York Times. He had a piece last week about all that's going on with the Olympics and NBC, and we just want to talk general TV media junk. So let's do that, huh? All right. First off, Mr. Sandomir, thank you for your time. I'm always hesitant to say I'm a long time reader of someone because I find it they find it less complimentary and more just makes them feel old. So it does.
And please do not call me Mister.
Okay. Oh, sorry. That's bad Midwestern habit. I apologize. Okay. Well, let's get into the interview, dog.
Okay.
All right. That was good. Okay. So you wrote a really solid piece, I thought, about the big news. Two solid pieces about the big news involving the NBC's Olympic TV deal. And basically, the Olympic deal it lasts until 2032, right?
Correct. Six Olympics through 2032.
Okay, so that is 18 years from now. That's right. Yes, that's about. So I did some math on this because I can do that because I'm a journalist and in this new age of 538 and Vox Media, journalists need to be able to do math. So
we need to be much wonkier than we used to be.
Exactly. As another less charitable person might put it, we need to know what the hell we're talking about now. So in 2032, Matt Lauer is going to be 75 years old.
Right.
Bob Costas is going to be 80, which is I find kind of impressive. Actually, I would have thought that he was more than 5 years older than Matt Lauer. No offense to either Matt Lauer or Bob Costas in that situation. And even Willie Geist will be 57 at that point.
But you know, Keith Costas will only be about 43 or 44.
Yeah, but Keith Costas by then will have like transcended like television. He'll be like he'll be a czar of something, I'm sure.
Right.
So it's to me the amazing part about this deal is, as you pointed out in your piece, we don't even know. Like in 1996, I don't know about you, I had an email address assigned to me by the University of Illinois that I hadn't used yet, and that was the University of Illinois. We invented Gopher. We had Mark Andreessen there. Like we had all sorts of technology stuff there, and I wasn't using it at all. The idea of how, when you think about how dramatically things have changed since 1996 and how that you can just assume just the way technology works just from history, they're going to change even more so in the next 18 years. I know the deal says that, this will account for technological changes, mm-hmm. but how could they possibly do that?
Well, it's not like they're predicting or saying we know that it's going to go in any direction. But if suddenly there is a new, new form of digital, I mean, whatever form of distribution is created, it will be covered by it. Now, it could cover some a la carte thing. Some, if we talk about, as we may talk about in a few minutes, the future of the bundle, and people talk about the bundle falling apart and everybody going their merry way with a la carte packages, or buy what you want to watch. It has to find some way to, NBC has to find some way to hold on to whatever distribution there is, even if they're selling the Olympics, person by person. But you don't know in what format that will be. You don't know whether bundles will be recreated in some newfangled way. Remember, you talk about going back 18 years. Talk about just going back 5 years, 6 years to before there was Twitter, before there was the ease with which social media has become part of our lives. We don't know what's going to happen in 2 years, let alone 18. But I guess to the best of NBC's ability, they're going to hold on to every kind of distribution, current or future, current or unformed, current or uncreated. They haven't done this before. When they made a deal in 95 that took them out until 2008, things didn't change quite as much between then, I don't think, as from 2008 till now.
I mean, how do we even know what NBC's going to be in 2032?
We don't. It may still be part of Cabletown, but Cabletown could be part of something else. So Ken Howard will be too old to run Cabletown.
I know. Thank you for doing this.
It is mind-blowing in that sense because, we know that sports TV deals are done 10, 15, 20 years in the future. The SEC deal that ESPN created to create the SEC network, that's a 20-year deal. But, and that's got to include all sorts of broad language that says ESPN will be able to take advantage of every kind of future distribution and medium that they can. Everybody's got to be doing this because hardly anybody making a deal now, will be in charge in 18 years. So, I don't know if it's pie in the sky. It's just like wishful thinking that a media company can control things as they do now.
But, I mean, do we even know? That's the thing, though, is that, could this be? And I don't mean to disparage NBC. I think that they've actually had a pretty good year in the ratings, as a matter of fact. It feels like a deal this long could end up being like an Enron field type of deal, where 3 years in, they're like, okay. We need to change the name. We need to move this somewhere. Maybe not 3 years. I think NBC will be around in 3 years. But the point is that that's so far into the future that the notion of television could seem weird. The notion of I always joke about 10 years. YouTube is 8 years old, and even that feels kind of rickety and old sometimes. It seems how can either the NBC or the Olympics. Does Olympics have an out in this deal if it turns out it turns out NBC, the head of Cabletown, realized that now they're only making refrigerators. So unless we're going to show these games on the inside of a freezer, there's we don't want you to be our broadcaster anymore.
That's certainly conceivable, but I wasn't forward-thinking enough to ask that question. If you look towards the other side, though, will there be an Olympics worth watching in 18 years? Will it become too bloated? Will there be, will it all be, slope style? Will all the old style sports be out the door? We don't know. Certainly there are a lot more events than there used to be in both the Summer and Winter Olympics. But, with Rio coming up and Rio being in the worst shape any host city has been, according to what the IOC said or somebody said, who knows what the tipping point that is? Who knows if that will lead to a world where the Summer Olympics and Winter Olympics are competed in the same city from Olympic to Olympic? Who knows? The Olympics can change as much as the mediums, the media can change. It is a weird deal to know that, Chelsea Clinton could be president. Who knows? By 2032. So, I think this is, the very definition of a futures deal, where no one knows what the landscape's going to be, other than that whatever remnants of the IOC and NBC and Cabletown exist, they will be tied together by a contract.
So is it, so do they do it just because they need each other so badly? Is NBC that doomed, not doomed, but is NBC Sports that empty if they, you know, is this like the Miguel Cabrera deal where you're just like, hey, we could have waited a couple of years before we extended this? Why did they feel the need to do this extension?
Well, NBC has since August of 95 made it clear that they would rather, you know, be certain of what they're going to have going forward many, many years. And, you know, in 95 they did two deals totaling, two separate transactions totaling five deals and $3.5 billion. So, and that taking them through 2008. The advantage to them is knowing that they're going to be dominating February and August, or July or August or September, depending on where the Olympics are, for 17, 18 days at a time, or at least that's the supposition, that they will dominate prime time completely, and that is great for the company and great for not only NBC broadcast, but NBCSN. The IOC, which may well have left a lot of money on the table, knows that they can plan on getting $7.5 billion over the next 18 years. In fact, it's a $100 million signing bonus that's usable between 2015 and 20 to market the Olympics. So, you know, it's, these are, for want of a better phrase, you know, codependent partners. They desperately need each other. And I think from the last couple of, the last two times this has gone out to competitive bidding, you know, NBC has proven that they will overbid greatly to keep what it has, and the IOC is more than happy to go into a private deal and negotiate privately with NBC and keep the relationship going. It's, you know, Dick Ebersole established it, nurtured it, and Jacques Roga and Samaranch and now Thomas Bach. You know, Bach said something very, very interesting the other day. He said, when asked why such a deal for so long, so much sooner than he had to, he said, essentially, we didn't want to run the risk of taking more money, even a dollar more, on the chance that another network could ruin it, ruin the Olympics, ruin the broadcasting. And, you know, it's a fascinating sense of how close they are that he could say that about ESPN, which pretty much would know how to do the Olympics, and Fox, which would know how to do the Olympics. They all have similar skill sets. NBC just has the institutional memory.
Yeah, it is kind of a weird thing to say. I mean, I don't think anyone, whatever issues anyone would may or may not have with ESPN, I don't think anyone would say, oh, they could never handle an event of that scale. I would only trust NBC to do that. Like, it is,
no,
it,
but
it's like strange.
They handle the World Cup.
Greatly,
A month-long event, they handle that. Fox, you know, they didn't bring Bart Simpson in to call the NFL when they got the NFL deal. So, you know, Fox can be a little crazy on the edges, but they're the same as everybody else in terms of their ability to do high-level sports without embarrassing themselves. There are always glitches. There are always problems here and there. But, you know, CBS can't do it at the Olympics. Well, they've done three Olympics. They've done the last three Olympics that somebody besides NBC did. They could do it, too. You know, and I think the main reaction from the networks that were left out of all this was surprise, not, oh boy, I wish we were really in there because we were going to overbid NBC. They know they're not going to overbid NBC. NBC is going to blow them out, whether in a competitive bid or privately. So it's to me it's a fascinating relationship, and you know, I don't think the only thing maybe remotely like it is CBS and the Masters, but they only do, you know, 1 year at a time.
Yeah, I think it may have something to do with the Starbucks that they brought to Sochi. I still feel like that's an aspect of it. It's funny because I was in Sochi this year. It was my first time I covered the Olympics, so it was the first time I didn't watch any of it on television. The only things I caught. Of course, that's the weird thing about the Olympics is, you know, if it's such a television event. That for that, you know, if you're, I felt like I actually had much less of an idea of what was going on than my wife did, because she was actually watching, she was informing me of what was going on all the time. And of course, but of course, it gets so skewed that, like, you know, the two biggest stories were the question that, I forgot the name of the NBC reporter who asked the question of the skier that and made him cry. That and Costas's eye. Like, apparently, those were like the two biggest stories of the Olympics. But I mean, you sure you watched a lot of it and were around for it. Like, was this a? I can't tell. Was this a successful Olympics television?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. They averaged 20. They won every night. They averaged 21.4 million viewers. They had more, more digital viewers, more people, watching video live. They all the events were streamed live, so that nobody can complain that everything was not available. No, it was very successful. It's one reason why NBC went ahead with this deal. They, since Comcast took over, they've done two Olympics with NBC, and both have been they tell us profitable. There are no independent reports of profitability, but they never have been. So we have to rely on what they're saying that they are profitable. But yes, it was a very successful Olympics, and it's more successful if you're in North America, and more successful if you're in North America in the Eastern time zone than if you are 8 or 9 hours away in Europe or Eastern Europe. But this was very good, and certainly very good in comparison to Torino, or Turin, as most of us say. Vancouver is a big deal. It's virtually the United States. So no, it was very successful, and having more digital available is a very big thing. Even though I think 76% of all viewing was still done on television, and that's the story. In many ways, you can make money selling advertising for digital, but the bellwether stuff is really and truly those 4 hours in prime time. It's where most of the money is made, and yes, you build up NBCSN far beyond what it usually is, but it's still a prime time thing. That's where 21.4 million people watch. So, that may still be the formula in 10 or 15 years. If the world is all watching everything on a tablet or an iPhone or some version of it, if we are become a country of little screens, I think that blows my mind. I still think people want to sit back and watch a television.
And it's funny, that leads me in a little bit of, because in my the idea we were talking about with bundling, because it does feel, forget it, putting aside a la carte for a moment, it does feel strange to me. The only thing that feels strange to me about the Olympics, because it makes sense, because it's not, people don't watch it the way they watch sports. It's probably, right. There's no way you would ever package a primetime thing that already happened for any other sport in the Olympics, because it's not, frankly, it's not really.
It's primetime entertainment, and combining a bunch of sports that nobody watches on a regular basis.
Yeah, so I get that, but in every other aspect in sports and cable, people keep telling us how the sports is buoying everything up because people have to watch it live. Like I can't tell if the Olympics is just this unique outlier or if it is outdated, if that makes sense, in a lot of ways. Because on one hand, yes, most people are still watching it on television, most people are watching it on prime time, it's not sports. Okay. I say that because in every other it's obviously athletics. But it's not like, the people don't watch, sports fans don't watch it the way that, what I'm saying. And
No, I mean, it's in terms of what we are seeing, it's an outlier product. In terms of its value to a media company, it is, it's the value of live sports of cubed, even if it isn't live sports. Because sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But there was a lot of stuff live on NBCSN and the other cable networks. But I get your point. It is a bit outdated. It is an outlier. But everything else we talk about, the NFL, there's a new Major League Soccer deal, baseball, everything else. Those are college football. The amount of money being paid for the college football playoff, $7.3 billion. The amount of money for ESPN's paying for football, the NFL, $15.2 billion over 8 years. These numbers go up. ESPN went from $1.1 billion a year to $1.9 billion a year. It's because they need it. They need it to maintain their sub fee. And everybody needs these sports to maintain their sub fees. So that's what ties, and all the regional sports networks, that are paying teams exorbitant amounts of money, $80 million, $130 million a year. That is part of the, you know, local money that goes into revenue sharing. This stuff, this is huge amount. These are huge amounts of money that are propping up salaries. The, you know, it's a whole economy that is flowing by what networks and regional sports networks are paying for the rights. You know, there may be a bubble bursting, but right now it doesn't seem like it's ready to burst.
And I think, and that's the thing I find interesting is, I wonder if it's the other way around, that like, and this goes with the idea of bundling, because I wrote a piece saying that like, while sports, you know, I've one of my best friends, she does, not only does she not like sports, she's like one of those people that like makes fun of you for liking sports. Like, you're like, hey, Will, are you playing fantasy baseball? I just hit a home run. Yay, points. I'm like, no, it's not like Dungeons and Dragons. I'm not rolling a die. Like, she, you know, she doesn't, nothing against Dungeons and Dragons, but she doesn't quite get it. She doesn't care about sports at all, in the same way that I don't care about a lot of things that aren't sports. But I'm not paying $5 a month out of my cable bill. For I may be paying 35 cents for Animal Planet. Actually, I like Animal Planet. 35 cents for MTV2. But I'm not watching. You know, I'm not watching that. But that's okay. I'm only paying a small amount of it. And we generally understand this idea that, you know, there is this bundling notion. But to me, I think it's hard to separate the issue with bundling and whether this is going to, since the rest of the culture seems to be going a la carte and cable's kind of this one kind of holdout in that, it's hard to separate sports from that because sports is propping so much of cable up. So my question is, if bundling, first off, is bundling actually in trouble? And two, if it is, does that put some of our sports in jeopardy because it is such a large part of the revenue right now?
You know, occasionally you see numbers that say people are cutting their cords and numbers that should be alarming, and then sometimes you see numbers that say the cable operators have stanched that flow. First off, sports will not be available in the way Netflix does House of Cards. Sports are tied up for so long, the major sports are tied up for so long, that you can't imagine any way in which they would be available in a la carte mode. So if you have these 20 and 30 year contracts for Major League Baseball on RSNs, or 8 or 10 or 20 year deals on the major national networks, you may eventually just be buying a bundle of sports networks, and everything else could go a la carte. Now, you can see a bundle. You can see a bundle of news. You know, I mean, you could see what everybody has talked about, that there could be bundles of small bundles that people, things that people want. And when you think about it, only a small minority of people are actually watching sports. So a small minority is propping that up. Most people are not watching these sports on any regular basis. Yet we're paying $4 or $5 a month for a new Dodger network, the new Laker network, all these networks, and you know, networks aren't going out of business. They're just adding more. I think LA has about 6 of them. We didn't lose. MSG lost all of baseball, but they didn't lower their rights, their sub fee. Just because they have the Knicks and the Rangers, doesn't mean that it costs any less for them than when they had the Mets and the Yankees. So there's nothing ever goes down. It's the greatest business in the world to have a cable network, because you have affiliate agreements, especially for sports. These go up and up and up and up. And as long as these teams and these leagues are tied long term to contracts, it seems like there's going to be some bundle. I'm not smart enough to know where it's going to be in 5 or 10 years, but and there may be a shakeout in markets where there are too many RSNs. But you see, I've been doing this long enough to know that the NFL that the networks once rolled back their rights fees.
So that's hilarious.
So, I believe it's the NFL who allowed the NFL, that allowed the networks to roll back the rights fees because of the recession in the early 90s. So that'll never happen. Everybody goes up 20, 30% or more. You know, to me, the negotiations between the NFL and the ESPN have always been fascinating because the ESPN always pays the biggest increase because they see value in getting more and more rights to more and more things so they can have more and more shows to, as you know, it's part of their shoulder programming around the games, so around Monday Night Football, and they finally have a playoff game this year. So I just don't see, you know, an immediate or near-term scenario where sports is on anything but some kind of bundle that costs the lion's share of what people pay, or at least, you know, a good portion of what people pay. It's pretty amazing. I pay $230 from my cable bill, and I do have HBO and Showtime, but you know, I have everything essentially. It's very costly. I keep saying the same thing. I don't envision a time where sports goes off into some Netflix-like land.
Is it? Well, it's funny because I think about this now, because like right now I have my cable bill, and I also pay for MLB TV, mm-hmm. and which is I think it's one, the premium is like $115 a year. So and I'm curious because it's not a matter of, I think about like what the Houston Astros went through this year. The Houston Astros kind of went through a situation where they kind of overplayed their hand, and in a way that some people are claiming the Dodgers are doing now, which to me, someone pointed out the other day that like if it turns out that this is Vin Scully's last year. Mm-hmm. And Dodger fans don't get to watch him in his last year. I hadn't thought about it that way because I just watch Dodger games whenever I want because I don't live in Los Angeles. And so, but when you look at, it does appear to at least, the providers are pushing back a little. It seems like they're pushing back a little, at least not in the national sense, but maybe in these local stations and so on. And they're putting pressure on, I think Dish Network is the main thing in Los Angeles. And I'm curious, because if there are enough people that stand up, and that say, you know what, I don't want to pay $5 a month or however much a month, who don't care about sports. If that unbundling happens, do you imagine a situation? Because I have to say, if you gave me the opportunity to say, Will, either you're going to pay $350 a month to watch sports, or you're not going to watch sports, I have to say I'd pay it. Mm-hmm. I'd pay it, and you could probably go up with that number an uncomfortably high amount, it's funny because I feel like this is the one time in the world that sports fans are not actually getting gouged. It's non-sports fans that are getting gouged, but only because they don't have to, and I feel like eventually they just will.
Well, yeah, and you know, there have been estimates for, you know, if the bundle fell apart, how much would ESPN cost? And in a way, it would adjust arithmetically. If there are only, you know, 20 million subscribers, people would pay, you know, four times what they're paying now. Is it worth it even at that level? Some people would find it is worth it to spend $20, $25 a month for ESPN. There is a lot there. ESPN's, you know, PR hype is often, look at how much value we provide not only to the viewers but the cable, cable affiliates. You would see a percentage of people that is more like the percentage of people who actually watch are the ones paying for this stuff. Now, you'd say, okay, I want to pay for, in New York, I want to pay for the S Network. I'm not a Met fan, so I don't want to pay for SNY, so that's out the window. I want to pay for, you know, MSG, but not MSG2. I want to pay for this or that. So that's the ultimate choice, but no one has been willing. Well, first off, consumers haven't had that choice, and the cable operators have usually buckled under. You know, this whole distribution thing in LA is just at a higher level in terms of sub fee than almost every other battle. You know, the Yes battle with Cablevision over carriage in 2002 and 2003. It happens almost everywhere. There's a new network or sub fees go up. It is just it's utterly predictable. Especially when in a market where a team has gone from one from like prime network where the Dodgers were on Fox to their own network, yet prime didn't go away. You know, it's too many RSNs for a market that, while it is a huge market, is dominated by one particular cable operator, Time Warner, and which is merging with Cable Town. So everything is, you know, when I was wondering why MSG doesn't charge less, it's because everything is interconnected. MSG is a cable programmer and a cable network, so that, you know, they want their, you know, they don't want to offend Time Warner, because Time Warner is going to, you know, not put MSG on Time Warner, and Time Warner has programming it wants to have on here and there. So everything is intertwined. So that's why it keeps, you know, sub fees don't go down. If there was some division between a media company being a programmer and an operator, we might see different things. We have the Comcast situation with Tennis Channel, where they've been going to the Supreme Court over a case about whether the Tennis Channel belongs on Comcast systems, exactly where Comcast put its own Golf Channel, which is same parallel kind of network. And the Supreme Court said no, I believe that's where it went, and they're still going through. Now they're going through FCC channels again. So it's, but if Comcast were just a cable operator, that case wouldn't have happened. They wouldn't have owned the Tennis Channel. So it's, you know, everything is interconnected. They have mutual interest. They want to make the most out of, and but again, these cable programmer, cable operator deal disputes, you know, they're normal. They just get a little more serious when you have, you know, $4 or $5 a month sub fees as opposed to $2 a month sub fees. I remember when $2.50 a month was considered a lot of money for a local RSN, but now, you know, and ESPN used to be reasonable at a dollar or two or three, but the NFL helped to change that.
Well, I think it's pretty clear now that this industry is stable and completely predictable enough that I should make an 18-year bet on it. I want to get together with NBC, the Olympics, and all the cable providers and be like, okay, can we lock in how much I'm going to pay my cable bill? I'll sign a 20-year contract. I'll sign a 20-year contract, and we'll see how it happens. And I, no matter what happens with bundling, I'm going to bet I would come out ahead. If I got a chance to sign that deal.
Well, yes, if you're willing to sign a 20-year contract, that you might be able to do that, but you'd have to almost create a class action of people who are willing to do the same thing, and of course, nobody's going to be a signatory on the other end. So, you know, it's a worthwhile idea, but, you know, eventually you're going to be charged for what they produce, and your only hope is that everything goes a la carte and you're able to choose what you want. And if that results in a situation where there isn't enough money flowing to one network, then that, you know, there'll be a natural consolidation, and some networks will go out of business and they'll turn to something else. They'll carry less expensive sports. But, you know, from what we hear, I mean, what used to be an expensive sport is now getting more expensive. The new MLS deal is supposed to be announced tomorrow. It's going to take MLS from about $18 million a year to 7-year radio, $90 million a year. That's a lot of money. But soccer is getting big. And, you know, I remember when the World Cup, nobody paid any money for the World Cup in the United States. It was a revenue share. Now it's an expensive deal. When a sport gets popular and suddenly there's bidders for it, you know, NBC's just finishing up their first year of English Premier League rights. But unlike, U.S. leagues, they have no right of first refusal. They have no matching rights. So in a year or so, EPL will be negotiating another 3-year deal. And NBC has raised the value of the league. They're not making any money on it. So they might not want to afford what it's going to cost next time when they're paying about $83 million a year. It could go for 2 or 3 times that. Yeah. So, you know, there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason. It doesn't seem to be any rationale for the numbers going down, as long as there are new competitors like Fox Sports One comes in, and, you know, NBCSN, which, you know, was not exactly invisible as Versus, but they are now an integral part of the NBC Comcast family, and they have to have better programming, and they're getting better programming. They need to establish great studio stars. They don't have anybody, you know, like that yet. But eventually, you program enough, somebody's going to be a big deal. They thought Michelle Beadle was going to be a big deal, and she washed out there. So, you know, who knows? But, you know, as everybody establishes, you know, extra networks, ESPN established ESPNU, and you know it's you know and the SEC network is just another network for ESPN to program the SEC. So you know it just keeps going on and on and on. It's fascinating. I don't really get bored. It's 23 years on this beat, and there's always a new wrinkle.
Yeah, I'm living in Athens. The SEC network is not on charter here, and there's only one game that Georgia plays on the SEC network in here, but in this town. But I'm telling you, this town is gonna lose its mind if they start flipping around and aren't able to find the game. That's gonna be a big problem.
But who's your cable operator?
It's Charter.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Charter. Well, so they're on Charter yet. So
I think they're going to have a serious problem with the citizenry if they don't make a deal.
Yeah, it's you know, as I said, there's Athens. I love it here, but you know, it's college football and cool young rock bands. I'm too old to go see. all right. Thanks, man. This is as enlightening and great as always, and I'm a huge fan. I'm glad I finally got to get you on and chat with me. And I promise we will do this again. Before Matt Lauer turned 75.
And will you promise to take out some of my extended babbling, because I wasn't making sense at some point?
Please, you did great. Listen, anyone that listens to this show knows that half of my yesterday's show, I had that Sid Ziegler from OutSports, and I guess I had so many questions for them that I asked like six of them at once. And his response was like, I literally don't know what you want me to respond to. I'm like, wait, sorry, let me try again. So I believe you me, this is what happens. We're writers and journalists who are pretending to talk. All right, thanks for your time, man. I really appreciate
it.
This was great, and we'll chat soon again, I'm sure.
My pleasure. Thanks, Will.
Thank you. Bye. All right. Thank you to Richard Santamare. He's on the good side of the planet. I like that guy. You can follow him on Twitter at Rich Sandomir, RichSandomir. All right. So I apologize, by the way, that podcast and tomorrow's podcast were recorded early because of my travels this week. So be not confused if it turns out that Cabletown or Comcast, you know, imploded on Monday because you're hearing about this on Tuesday morning because we did this a little early. So I apologize. Anyway, this is a Willish Experience podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Wednesday's guest is Jason Wojciechowski, who is a blogger for Beanball.org, A's fan site, a member of the ESPN Sweet Spot Network. He's also a writer for ESPN.com and the co-editor of the recent Baseball Prospectus Annual, which I was honored to be a part of. It's the weekly baseball show. No matter what happens, we have a weekly baseball show. I will talk to him and you.